Chapter 7. Mrs. Fosdyke came in the following day to carry through the family reunion party, but one had the impression that this might be for the last time. Her teeth feeling so strange was keeping her awake, she said, and she could hardly bring herself to get up in the mornings. It could be a nervous breakdown coming on, Mrs. Pye had told her. It was one of the signs. Mrs. Bagthorpe, alarmed, told her children that they were to assist her in every possible way. If Mrs. Fosdyke had imagined that her strange teeth were going to make her the center of attention, she was sadly mistaken. The whole day was destined to be action-packed, even by Bagthorpian standards, and started, literally, with a bang. This bang was loud and somewhere outside, and fetched most of the household out to investigate. By then there was also cursing, Uncle Parker, wailing, Aunt Celia, and delighted squeals, Daisy. Uncle Parker had had his first motoring accident. This had been widely predicted for years, and the only surprising thing, as Mr. Bagthorpe could not resist pointing out, was that it had not been fatal. The only fatality so far had been Thomas, the toothy ginger Tom belonging to Grandma, who had been run over at almost exactly the same point in the drive as the present crash. What had happened was that Uncle Claude, when he returned from his fishing trip the previous evening, had parked his car in front of the house just round the last bend in the drive, made blind by thick shrubbery. Uncle Parker had come racing up in his usual style and rammed straight into the back of it. Directly in front of Uncle Claude's car, unfortunately, was Mr. Bagthorpe's, and the impact had been such as to seriously involve that, too. Mr. Bagthorpe had difficulty in concealing his delight at what had happened. "This must be the first multi-vehicle pile-up ever to occur in a private drive," he asserted. "I shall telephone the newspapers. What a story this will make! After all, you are a writer now, Russell, and any publicity is good publicity." He did not, in fact, do this, because he was not on speaking terms with the local papers after their coverage of the Bagthorpe burglary. The party soon sorted itself into two groups, one of which, principally the ladies, gathered in the kitchen, sobbing and wailing, and the other of which spent a long time in the drive shouting and arguing and apportioning blame. Uncle Claude's car had come off worst. It was quite telescoped. As Mr. Bagthorpe pointed out, if Aunt Penelope had happened to be seated in it at the time, praying, she would have been killed. He thought this a fine irony, and repeated it several times. Had Uncle Claude himself not been such a mild man, there was little doubt that Uncle Parker would have accused him of dangerous parking on a blind bend, and not only disclaimed all responsibility, but gone after him for damages. As it was, Uncle Claude was so genuinely distressed by what had happened, and so apologetic, that the gravel was cut from under Uncle Parker's feet. The entire party eventually entered the kitchen, where much confusion still reigned. Mr. Bagthorpe did nothing to improve matters by dispensing liberal tots of brandy. He said this was medicinal for shock, but he looked more as if he were celebrating. The only ones who drank the brandy were himself, Uncle Parker, Grandma, and Mrs. Fosdyke, who said she would have just a drop, though she doubted if it would help. After his third brandy, Mr. Bagthorpe was cheerfully telling Aunt Penelope, "Man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward," Job 5, verse 7. He had suspected that he might be able to get this in quite a lot. He seemed, for the moment, to have overlooked the fact that, without a car, the D.B. were not going to be able to leave the following morning as they had planned. When he was later reminded of this by William, his mood underwent an abrupt change. "Verily I say unto you," he said, "there is no silver lining but what it has a cloud, or whatever." Grandma had quite a lot of brandy, because she said the accident had brought back to her in all its awful detail the day Thomas had been killed. The trouble was, the more brandy she drank, the more she seemed to remember this. "I can see him now," she told them, "that great golden jewel of an animal, struck down in his glorious prime. A light went out of my life that day."
We already know that.
"Poor Grandma Bag," said Daisy sympathetically. "Was there a lot of blood?" "You should not speak so in front of the child," Aunt Celia cried. "So sensitive and so impressionable." "I expect the blood was all over everywhere," Daisy said speculatively. The mention of blood seemed to rouse the Old Testament in Aunt Penelope, whom no one could stop from describing what would have happened had her family been actually inside the car when Uncle Parker arrived. Mrs. Bagthorpe kept trying to tell her that the odds against a family going straight out after breakfast and sitting in their parked car were millions to one, but she could not be brought to see this. "Dust to dust and ashes to ashes," Mr. Bagthorpe told her. "That's the way it goes, Penelope, you know that." Grandma was irritated by Aunt Penelope's trying to steal the limelight with a purely hypothetical accident. "No one is dead," she told her sharply. "I am the only bereaved person here. I think I may have to go up to my room and lie down." Mr. Bagthorpe agreed that this might be advisable in view of the quantity of brandy she had drunk so early in the day, and suggested that Aunt Penelope should do the same. "My place is at my husband's side," she replied frigidly. "This is a time of trouble." "It's that, all right," Mr. Bagthorpe agreed. "Eh, Russell? Going to shoot the insurance up a bit this lot, isn't it?" Uncle Parker replied, "There is one thing, Henry. A respray is not going to do your car any harm. Get some of your old dents and scratches thrown in at the same time. It's an ill wind." At this stage, no one was bothering much about Uncle Claude's written-off vehicle, and he himself did not seem to like to bring it up. Mrs. Bagthorpe tried to create a more cordial atmosphere by exclaiming, "You must stay to lunch, of course, now that you are here, Celia. Then we can have a reunion lunch and party." Mr. Bagthorpe pointed out that the reunion was being organized solely for the benefit of Grandma, and that she would most probably still be sleeping at lunchtime. Mrs. Fosdyke said that she had not counted on catering for lunch as well as tea, and Aunt Celia said that she wished to return to her own home as soon as possible. "I have lost my sense of cosmic security," she told them. "I must try to recapture it before it is gone forever." All this being so, Uncle Parker volunteered to organize the towing away of the three vehicles, and said he would ask the garage at the same time to send an extra car for his own use. Jack heard him ordering it over the telephone. "And make it something fast," he heard him say. "It's these crawling jobs that cause all the accidents." "Can I stay?" Daisy asked. "I want to stay and be with Grandma Bag because of poor Thomas." Aunt Celia was at first dubious about this, because she said that Daisy had had sufficient trauma for one day. But Rosie eagerly volunteered to keep an eye on Grandma and make sure she did not say anything unsuitable. "I've got lots of lovely things I can show Daisy," she told Aunt Celia, meaning the maggots and molds. Rosie was devoted to Daisy, mainly because she was younger and had hardly any strings to her bow, if Aunt Celia's claims were discounted. With Esther around, Rosie needed Daisy more than usual. Aunt Celia reluctantly agreed. "If Daisy asks for paper and pencil, give them to her immediately," she told everyone. "If she can write a poem about what has taken place, it will be cathartic. When I get home, I shall try to write one myself." Mr. Bagthorpe endorsed this instruction. "If she asks for paper and pencil and you don't supply it," he warned, "there is little doubt that she will begin writing her thoughts on the walls again." In the event, Daisy showed no recognizable signs of wanting to write poems either on paper or on the walls. Later, most people present were to wish she had occupied herself half so harmlessly. When the Parkers had gone, Mr. Bagthorpe returned to his study in high good humor, saying that he was in exactly the right mood for getting on with his script. His enjoyment of the morning had been heightened by the arrival of the breakdown men. They had been full of pithy humor about pile-ups in private drives, and had driven off laughing. By evening, it was certain, the entire neighborhood would be in possession of the story, and the accounts given would doubtless be more highly colored than any newspaper reports. As Mr. Bagthorpe went into his study, he was heard to say something about a Daniel come to judgment, probably, in his euphoric state, imagining this to be a biblical reference. Aunt Penelope and Luke retired to do their testing and assimilation, accompanied by Esther. The young Bagthorpes retired to William's HQ to decide on their course of action. Daisy was allowed along, too, though under sufferance. "You know what she's like," Jack told Rosie. When Daisy had done creative things with water, he himself had come in for a good share of the shouting. "She is sweet," Rosie maintained, "and she's only little. If she doesn't come, I'm not."